Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Season 3 of the Fanfiction Tapes. I'm your host today, Maya, pronouns she, her, and today I'm joined by...
Brian, he, him.
And I am our producer, Ian, pronouns he, him.
Today's episode is a story spotlight on Shakespeare, or, well, less of a specific story spotlight and a little bit broader, because Shakespeare wrote a lot of things. For those of you who are less familiar, Shakespeare was an English playwright.
And poet. He was active during the Elizabethan times, so late 1500s, early 1600s, out of England.
It's not definitively actually known when he started writing. The earliest records is 1592.
Shakespeare has been pretty influential. It's pretty common for, at least in American English classes, to read Shakespeare at least once a year in high school.
Yep. I remember every year that we did, we did Othello, didn't do The Tempest. I wanted us to do The Tempest, but Othello was one of the big ones.
And I think a lot of high schools do Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, my high school did Romeo and Juliet.
It helps that there are a couple dozen movie versions of that. Not so much for Othello.
Yeah.
There's a board game, though, although the board game has a tenuous link at best.
There's an Othello board game.
Oh, yes.
Huh.
My wife destroys me at it, so.
Today on Things I Didn't Expect to Learn. So Shakespeare's been pretty influential. All of us have to read, well, not all of us, but a lot of us have to read his work over and over again. And he's had some other effects beyond just that. There's a lot of phrases and words in modern-day English that we can trace back to Shakespeare.
Just from Hamlet, you get there's something rotten in the state of Denmark and all its infinite variations. You get there's a method to the madness. And, you know, there's a couple dozen others. And really, what's interesting about the particular time when Shakespeare wrote was the English language was going through a period of really intense flux. So over the 600 or so years preceding Shakespeare, the English language had been rapidly developing and changing, in no small part due to all the people who kept invading England and taking over and mashing up their languages with English. And then in the 14 and 1500s, as the English wanted to become less of a backwater and make the language more interesting, more formal, more respectable, they deliberately infused as much Greek and Latin as they could into the language, often with no particular plan or method to it. So that's why, for example, a woman has quintuplets, but they might grow up to work in the Pentagon, quint and penta, both coming to five, but coming from different languages. So the educated of England were busily trying to incorporate all these Greek and Latin terms and phrases, especially in the learned arts, you know, math, science, and whatnot, in order to prettify English. And so there was, of course, a reaction to that and pushback. And so in the years preceding Shakespeare coming onto the scene, there was a lot of flux in English in how it was written, pronounced, spoken, what words go in it. And Shakespeare is sometimes credited with having a stabilizing effect in, or at least being part of a movement that helped to stabilize it by essentially by being so well known and repeating the words that were in it and people relating to it and learning them, the literature of the time really helped stabilize English and bring it out of this period of intense flux and sort of formalize, okay, this is what our language is, this is what it's about.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of words that are credited to Shakespeare. He may not have actually been the one to invent them, but he's at least the first one to write them down. And a brief list of things that, you know, sound like they've been in the language since it was invented to us modern days, but admirable auspicious, baseless, barefaced, belongings, as in your personal possessions, clangor, loud noises, dawn. These are all words that are first attested in writing in Shakespeare.
Yep, and so whether he invented them or not, it's impossible to tell. He may have invented some of them as needed because of the particular way that he wrote, but whether he did or not, he either introduced or popularized them and brought them into the corpus of the English language, as linguists like to call it, and so helped to serve as a stabilizing factor. So we owe a lot to Shakespeare.
Yeah, that's actually a lot of specifics that I didn't know. I didn't know that actually the influx of Greek and Latin into English happened around that same time. I'm familiar with it. I'm an engineer. So, you know, I see parts of that in the day-to-day, but...
I think that's a thing that has happened in waves in the English language. Because yeah. I know there's also a... post-Elizabethan Enlightenment era, where there was a lot of Greek and Latin being reintroduced, sometimes incorrectly. For instance, octopus is occasionally hyper-corrected to the plural octopi, which would be correct if that was a Latin root, but it's not. It's a Greek root, and it's being used in English. So it doesn't matter.
Right. Counterpoint. Octopi sounds awesome.
It does. Use that if you want. It's language.
Right.
The rules are made up.
Yeah, we're talking about the same period, right? The influx of Greek and Latin, it's because of the Enlightenment and the Renaissance, where those languages were seen as the height of learning. If you wanted to communicate with your learned peers anywhere within the realm of civilization, you had to use Greek and Latin to do it. And so to prettify the English language, the linguists of the day tried consciously to incorporate as much Greek and Latin as their peers could stand. But again, with no central authority or overriding plan, so it got a little messy. And Shakespeare was right in the middle of it. So, and there's a fun way that this manifests, so which is an occasional anachronism. So a lot of times Shakespeare will have his characters swear by Greek or Roman gods. And they're doing that consciously. He was writing that in the fashion of the day, right? Again, because there was all this reach back to these ancient civilizations because that was seen as the golden age of humanity. He was having his characters speak in that fashion, even if that wouldn't make sense for the people for whom he was allegedly writing, like people in Greece swearing by the Roman pantheon, for example.
Yeah, I think I remember seeing something similar. Actually, I read Midsummer's Night Dream at one point. I'd completely forgotten about this. And just you talking about that reminded me of, yeah, that he would do that.
I was just thinking of the framing device of Midsummer Night's Dream. It's set in Athens and revolves around the marriage of Theseus and Hippolyta, you know, from Greek legend. But the way that the various characters and such are referred to is in terms of the English gentry and common folk of England in the 16th century.
Yep, history and geography were less important than to Shakespeare than what makes people tick.
And I mean, fair enough. Evidently, it did him well.
Well, ironically, this is one of the things that becomes less of a problem the further that we get from Shakespeare's time, because the less familiar that these different deities are to us, you know, we do lose some of the texture of the language when this happens, but it also becomes harder to spot when it doesn't work. But there is a cost to it, of course. For example, Iago, the villain of Othello, he frequently swears by Janus. Now, if you have no context, if you don't know who Janus is, you can readily identify that he's swearing, but that's it. And so the point comes across, but you lose a little bit of the texture. And the reason for that is that Janus in Roman mythology was a two-headed god, one head looking forwards, one head looking backwards. Incidentally, that's where the month January comes from, because it's the new year, so you're looking ahead and behind at the same time. So Iago is a very appropriate person to swear by that particular deity, because Iago is a traitor. He's literally a two-faced person.
Two-faced.
Right. So him swearing by Janus works very – is a clever little detail that you do lose some of the texture when you lose some of the context.
And this is why Shakespeare plays are for all time.
Yeah, all sorts of fun stuff in there. Isaac Asimov, in fact, did something like a 1,000-page book that is – that about 50% of it is just him digging up all of the allusions and explaining all the different phrases that don't make sense to a 20th century audience.
Interesting. Well, getting us a little bit back on track for the episode, what's everyone's favorite Shakespeare piece that they've read?
I'm a fan of Twelfth Night. I will say, though, that Kenneth Branagh put on a very good show with his take on Much Ado About Nothing.
I know I've read some of Shakespeare's sonnets at some point. Like, I remember that being a unit in one of my English classes. I don't remember anything really about them. Because he was a lot more than just a playwright. He wrote a lot of things. But I think what I enjoyed the most was probably Macbeth.
Macbeth is a fun one, but it depends upon how you read, how much fun you have with it depends upon the way that you're reading it, incidentally, I think.
Really?
Yeah, so a popular reading of Macbeth has Macbeth as, you know, sort of a mopey person who's, you know, angsting all over the place. And a bunch of modern takes. I remember there was one modern take on Hamlet, which seemed like it was shot entirely in grayscale, you know, like the Matrix aesthetic, but taken to an even more illogical extreme. But it's a lot more fun if you read it as a political thriller. It's not just Hamlet stalking the king. It's the king and Hamlet stalking each other. And if you realize that the evil uncle was a stock character in Elizabethan England, because this sort of uncle is the regent, takes over for his nephew who's the heir to the throne, who can't take the throne yet. And boy, it would be sure inconvenient if the uncle had to stay on the throne if something happened to the nephew. Yeah, the evil uncle was a stock character in the milieu of the day. So it would have been instantly recognizable to an Elizabethan audience that this is a very polite but very lethal power struggle that's going on in Hamlet.
Ian, what's your favorite Shakespeare?
I think it would probably actually be A Midsummer Night's Dream. I'm not sure if it's responsible for my interest in fairies and the fae in, like, the folkloric sense, or if it's because of that interest, but I think that's related. Because the main plots of that all revolve around the exploits of Oberon, Titania, and Puck.
Oh, Puck. Although, I suppose we should put in a point of order here, because when we talk about what our favorite Shakespeare is, because if we're just talking about the original manuscripts, or if we're talking about the many, many, many takes and reproductions of it that have happened over the years. So this is where we can kind of take it back to our area of speciality, which is fan fiction. And we can say Kenneth Branagh, for example, is doing, if he does anything you know, beyond just a reproduction of the text. He's basically making fan fiction, which you can do because Shakespeare's in the public domain. You know, there was a Leonardo DiCaprio take on Romeo and Juliet that was set in the modern day. That is, you could frame that as a Romeo and Juliet modern AU.
I mean, there's been a couple of those, haven't there?
Oh, many, but I was making the point that, you know, all of the various treatments of Shakespeare are, many of them fall within the tropes or vocabulary that we use when we're talking about fan fiction. You know, it's a modern take on this, right? We would just call that a modern AU, for example. So the fact that Shakespeare has been around for so long and there have been so many different takes on it means that it's very firmly within the realm of fan fiction and the realm of things that we specialize in.
Yeah, I think my first exposure to Shakespeare was, or at least earliest that I can solidly identify, I was probably exposed to some even earlier, but not as direct, was a movie called Romeo and Juliet, which was a garden gnome AU of Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah, and there was a zombie movie a couple years back when zombies were popular that was basically sort of a zomcom. It was a it was kind of loosely based on Romeo and Juliet, except one of the characters was a zombie. I wish I was making this up, but I'm totally not.
I mean, just given how people are, that's it's not too surprising. That's less surprising to me than the Othello board game.
Well, and then 10 Things I Hate About You, of course, is a Taming of the Shrew modern high school AU.
Can't say I'm familiar with the adaptation. I've heard bits about Taming of the Shrew.
Yep, and so it's funny that the comedies tend to have more elaborate or more verbose titles as opposed to the tragedies and the histories are overwhelmingly named just after their protagonists. So on the one hand, you have like A Midsummer's Night Dream or As You Like It. And then on the other hand, you have Hamlet and Othello, or even if he's feeling very spicy, Titus and Andronicus. You know, the titles tend to be more elaborate for the comedies, which is kind of ironic, given that you can sort of tell that Shakespeare liked to do the tragedies a lot more than he did the comedies. Even the titles will tell you this. The titles for some of his comedies are like Much Ado About Nothing, which, okay, it's appropriate for the comedy because everything turns out nicely, but it's also, it could be seen as sort of self-referential about the story itself. Similarly, there's As You Like It, as opposed to How I, the Author, Like It. Even The Twelfth Night is a reference not to anything that happens in the play, because there's no mention of anything like that in the play. It's a reference to when the play was delivered to the audience who commissioned it.
Twelfth Night being, in the traditional Christian liturgical season of Christmas, Twelfth Night is the final night of Christmas.
Right, and so the play was commissioned and was supposed to be delivered on that occasion, and so it was named that for that reason instead of for anything, for meta reasons, if we want to use our modern vocabulary. The titles of the comedies are all very meta, and the titles of the tragedies are all very, very, strict shooting.
Hamlet, Macbeth, Romeo and Juliet.
Right, so you can sort of see here that, and if you also look at like where he spent all his work on his soliloquies and where he, really dug into giving characters these deeper and more intense motivations, you can sort of see that he really liked to do the tragedies more than he did the comedies. He did the comedies for the money, and he did the tragedies because he kind of dug them. And that's something that we as writers always have to have to think about, you know, how much of our writing is for our audience and how much of our writing is for ourselves.
Yeah, that's for me, that's one of the great things about fanfic, because the audience, I'm writing this for me. And I can do that because I'm not trying to make a living off it. I'm doing it for fun. But when you need to sell tickets to a play or sell copies of a book, that's probably not the wisest financial decision you could make.
Right. The calculus changes. And, you know, the movie industry always has people bemoaning that sort of thing as well. But you can, it's not new. You can see it as far back as Shakespeare very clearly. And yeah, as fan fiction, as fan fiction authors, sure, we a lot of times we'll write for ourselves, but there's also, even if we're not getting money out of it, we still a lot of times want to see other people read our works. We want to see other people be interested in the things that we've written. And so a lot of times there can be impulses or urges to bend the storyline in certain ways, or maybe toss in ships that we otherwise might not, because we think that it'll play well with whatever our audience is. And so that's how it manifests for us. Even if it's, you know, even if we're not having people who are commissioning our stuff, we still are social creatures and we don't exist in a vacuum. And we still have these influences that we see that drive us to certain storytelling decisions. And it's kind of comforting, I suppose, to know that that people have been dealing with that, with those contradictions and impulses for 500 years now. And, even the best of us.
That is actually an excellent segue. I was going to make that segue myself, and then you made it for me. Shakespeare's work is a lot of times considered kind of fancy, highbrow art. It's a lot of people, if you ask them what do they think of Shakespeare, they will probably think it's kind of fancy, harder to understand. It's those, one of those, like, I'm not quite able to grab the phrasing right now, but
it's for the educated, is right. Anything that you have to learn about in school, that you have to kind of study or get into to get the most out of, like opera, right? It's in that sort of genre of or that classification of those forms of art, highbrow, if you will, that are more seen as fancy schmancy, which is really ironic once you actually look at what Shakespeare wrote.
Because there's a lot of sex jokes in his books. Much Ado About Nothing, the title, is partly a pussy joke.
It's a triple pun, because in the dialect of the time, the word nothing would have been pronounced as closer to nutting, which is both, you know, the word nothing, as in there's nothing, but was also, noting was a slang term for gossip, and also a slang term for pussy. So the title, Much Ado About Noting, is a lot of fuss over nothing, or a lot of fuss over gossip, or a lot of fuss over pussy.
And as the text of the play bears out, all three of those readings are valid.
Mm-hmm. And if you really want to strike down notions of Shakespeare work being totally highbrow, read Titus Andronicus.
Yeah, I've heard that described as Shakespeare in a Quentin Tarantino phase.
That's pretty good, yeah. Select quotes. You have undone our mother. Villain, I have done thy mother.
I remember that quote. I
may be slightly misquoting that one, but...
Yeah. I don't know if that's Titus Andronicus, but...
I'm pretty sure it is.
Yeah, the point is that this may be the first recording in the English corpus of a Yo Mama joke.
Okay, yeah, that is... Titus Andronicus. I guess that one was just specifically mentioned in my English class, because we did talk about that. Yeah, it's, I think Shakespeare's a really good highlight of how thinking of art in terms of highbrow versus lowbrow is kind of bullshit. Art is art.
Right, because all audiences were present in the Shakespearean play theaters of the time. They had both the upper galleries for the highfalutin society, and they had the penny seats, you know, something that would almost resemble a mosh pit of the commoners down below stage level. So all audiences were present, and all audiences got to get a slice, if you know what I mean.
And you can see in some of his works where he's writing certain scenes to appeal to certain demographics. Midsummer Night's Dream is actually a pretty good example of this, because you have the Athenians, Theseus and Hippolyta being the framing device, their marriage being the framing device for the events of the play. But then you have the love quadrangle are also high society Athenians. But then you have this subplot of the quote-unquote rude mechanicals. And there's a lot more lowbrow humor in their scenes.
Well, so Twelfth Night, I adore Twelfth Night, and mm-hmm. it's... In many ways, if you just describe the plot in absence of Shakespearean terms, you would say, oh, that sounds like modern-day rom-com material. And in a lot of ways, it is. And but even though, you know, even through the middle of this very rom-com thing, which is all about mistaken identity and you know, I like them, but don't tell them. I would like you, but it can't happen. All of those... you know, misunderstandings amongst the elites, it also takes a break to have a very slapsticky section in the middle. Basically, where a bunch of people just run a prank on some of the main characters to try and get them to fight each other just to see what'll happen.
The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, I mean, it will always be the case that sex sells.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Okay, I wasn't sure if I wanted to bring this up. For those who are into conspiracy theories, Brian, are you familiar with the authorship question?
If you mean the scholarly question of if was there ever a person named William Shakespeare, then yes, I'm familiar with it. I tend to be kind of unimpressed by it because I don't know really how much it changes. In the end, given that we've got the, you know, the works have been well preserved over the years and the works are what really matter. But I am familiar with people quibbling over the existence, the theoretical existence or non-existence of William Shakespeare.
Yeah. To be clear, this is considered entirely fringe, total red string Pepe Silvia board conspiracy theory by mainstream literary scholars and historians. I just find that sort of thing funny.
Yeah, and there's also something to it, is a kind of other element to it as well, which actually, when you mentioned this to me before the episode, I was thinking that this meant how kind of media preservation came into effect of the way that plays were distributed at the time meant that part of the reason that we have versions of these plays at all is people would, you know, get a ticket, watch the play, and scribble down everything they could, and then run to someone else and try and recompile the play so they could put on their own production. Because copyright protection wasn't really a thing in the way that it is now.
Yep, which is why the authors always had to get paid in advance instead of by royalties. Because you couldn't be sure there would be any.
Mm-hmm. And so some of the words that we have now aren't quite probably aren't necessarily the ones that he put down originally.
Well, and to some extent, there is, you know, changes in pronunciation are one of the biggest ones. How words are pronounced has shifted in the English language over time, and that makes some of the jokes or some of the rhythm of it a little different than we would think of it otherwise.
Yeah, it's
Yeah, I think that comes back to contributing to the impression of it being highbrow, prestigious sort of thing, because it's widely studied in schools, but the language has changed enough since it was written that a lot of editions for study basically have a translation guide on the facing page.
Yeah, that's I have a lot of the Folger Shakespeare Library stuff that's got, you know, left page is, okay, here's all the weird shit they say and what it means, and the right page is what they say.
Now, going against the notion that a lot of the words might be in error, though, the rhythm is maintained. And that's one of the important things in the way that these plays are written, is there's an almost lyrical quality that, depending upon who's putting it on, that can either be almost completely suppressed or it can be really brought out. But because this was written in this very particular time signature, because he used it for all of his plays, you can have some confidence that the words can't have shifted too much, because otherwise it wouldn't work anymore. It is incidentally very nearly the same rhythm scheme that is used by more modern works such as Green Eggs and Ham.
Speaking of rhythm, this is a little off from what we're currently talking about, but the way that Shakespeare uses rhythm in his works is often indicative of class. Bringing up Midsummer Night's Dream again, Shakespeare famously writes in iambic pentameter. And, okay, a brief digression on poetic meter. Iambic refers to the pattern of stress in words. And by stress, I mean when you put the emphasis on the correct syllables. That sounded wrong, right?
That was actually something that I, like, missed a lot of in when I was going through the works, because it's been a long time since then, and we didn't really have very structured readings.
Right, and when you have people who are in high school who are looking at it for the first time and don't understand that that's a thing, you know, when people read aloud, they tend to read very flat. They tend to just, they're working so hard just trying to reproduce the sounds at all, that giving them any sort of livelihood or any sort of life is a lot of times lost, and you lose so much when that happens. So compare that again to the example I cited earlier. I do. I like them, Sam. I am, right? That is an iambic time signature, right? It's using the same thing. It's quadrameter instead of pentameter, but close enough. But when you say it with the right rhythm, it comes off completely different.
Yeah. So the iambic meter is da 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 da. You know, you have an unstressed followed by a stressed emphasis on the wrong syllable. And so
that
the
so
penta, it does, doesn't it?
That's what makes it such a great example.
Yeah, very obvious. And then the penta meaning five. So in a line, iambic pentameter means that in a line you have five patterns of unstressed, stressed. And the way that Shakespeare uses this to indicate class is that his upper class characters always have dialogue in iambic pentameter, but the commoner characters speak in free verse.
Or the idiot sitting in the back of the room with me What does that mean?
It means that there is just, it's just plain dialogue. There's no metrical structure to it.
Okay, that's kind of what I thought, because it's a little implied, but I figured it'd be best to clarify.
Sure, sure, sure.
Right, so we as authors are probably not going to write in iambic pentameter a whole lot in our fan fiction, because among other things, it's hard. You have to practice a lot at it. There was a reason that poetry was, when poetry had its last big cultural hurrah in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there was a reason that it was revered and that the people who were very good at it had high social standing, is because it was recognized as being skillful at something that is difficult to do. But that said, we can still understand this idea of rhythm and lean on it when it's important or useful. Whenever there are plenty of occasions, depending upon what you're writing, where there can be some sort of song or some sort of rhythm or something, speech or some sort of, you know, whenever I see a riddle that has no rhyme or rhythm scheme, I'm like, you can do better. It really, so, and I think this speaks to the point that you were making earlier, Ian, about it's noticeable when you go from structured to unstructured. Well, you can do the same in reverse. We write as just fanfic authors. We normally write in very unstructured prose. And so we can produce a very stark contrast if we then go into a very structured mode for special occasions. It becomes very noticeable.
Yeah, I basically never intentionally write with some particular structure like that. It's just putting words on the page.
Well, but it's a tool that you can have in your toolbox.
I just want to mention one other thing about meter and the way that Shakespeare uses it. I mentioned iambic pentameter. He also occasionally makes use of trochaic tetrameter. Troche is basically the opposite of an iamb, stressed then unstressed, and tetra meaning four. And he uses it in A Midsummer Night's Dream for the fairy dialogue, and he uses it in Macbeth for the witches.
Yep, so again, by going from one rhythm to another, it is used to mark off or produce contrast, right? It, like equivalence for fan fiction writers, if we're not talking about writing in rhythm specifically, it could be as, you know, when we use for contrast, bold or italics, or we're going to center this text instead of have it justified, or this person will in fact speak in rhyme as opposed to others who do not, right? This tool that he used for generating contrast, we may use different tools, but we can use them in similar ways where, hey, this is something that is unearthly. It is not going to speak in the way that we speak. Here is something that is unnatural or beyond us. It is not going to have the same rhythm or familiarity to the things that we have.
That's actually a pretty interesting way of putting it. I hadn't really thought of italics in bold that way, because I kind of tend to get annoyed by them. Sometimes I can find them distracting. And so I don't use them much in my own writing. Maybe once every like 20,000 words, right?
Right, because used too often, the contrast fades, right? So it's a tactical thing, right? You use them for producing these moments of great contrast. It's one thing to use them within just normal speech for adding emphasis where you want it, but I was speaking more broadly, like where you've got a section of text that will be rendered in all italics, for example, and it's a marker of this is something different from everything else around it. Now, caution, it's very easy to overdo these things, right? But it is something that you can bust out tactically.
Yeah, it's definitely something of like, a perspective shift for me of, you know, I should probably actually look at using things like that more, not just necessarily meter, but, you know, things like italics and bold. Because I kind of avoid it, and I think that in some ways is a little detrimental.
Yeah, but I understand where you're going. Like, it's very easy for us to see someone overuse them and go, I'm not going to be like that, and sort of like avoid these things on principle. You know, once burned, twice shy. But by doing so, we may be giving up tools that nevertheless have some utility.
Yeah, definitely. And it's also kind of a case of just perspective bias, and we're never too old to stop learning.
For sure. So another device that Shakespeare uses a lot that is not so common necessarily at first blush, we'll get there, is soliloquy. Now, Shakespeare is writing stage plays. There is no narration. There is no text that is conveying things beyond what the characters are saying or where they're going by stage direction. So anything... you know, almost anything that is done plot-wise has to be elaborated via dialogue, which if you're training yourself on how to make dialogue work for you, this is a rich source for you to draw on. But one of the main methods that is used for this is soliloquy. And soliloquy is a device where the one character will stop whatever action is going on and instead speak directly to the audience, right? He's not engaging with the other characters. He's just going on his own. Now, we can see in this sort of the predecessor to the modern villain's monologue sort of thing, but that's an important, that's a useful comparison, I think, because the function of soliloquy is to unpack the inner life of the character, and if you're really on your game, to also continue advancing the plot at the same time. So one of the character that gets the most soliloquies in Shakespeare's work, even more than Hamlet, is the villain Iago in Othello. And I mentioned before that he is a character who's two-faced, right? He's manipulating all the people around him. So how can you understand if he's lying to everyone all the time? How can you ever understand what he's thinking? And the solution is these extended soliloquies that are used where he talks to the audience. And in those moments and only those moments, he is unmasked. So for us as writers, it's important for us to understand the function that the soliloquies are serving in these moments is that they help us to unpack character motivations in sort of a more intimate way. Now, we don't have to do it by dialogue. You know, the villain's monologue trope, where the villain basically does this but to a captive audience, is sort of an evolution of the soliloquy, because again, the function of it is to unpack in a very expeditious manner all the things that make the villain tick, why they're doing what they're doing. But it doesn't have to be like that. For us as writers, because we're working in prose, we can have these moments where a character, you know, a villain is a good example, it's not just them, just stops to reflect on something. And we pause a moment, and it doesn't have to be a total pause. It's one of the great things about the soliloquies in Othello is that Iago is also explaining not just what he's doing, but how he's going to get his revenge, how he's going to take. So he's advancing the plot at the same time. But again, the purpose of these is to help us understand in a more intimate way these characters, and very expeditiously get a feel for what makes them tick. And so our devices aren't quite the same, But this, as a storytelling tool, I think is an important one to have, to know when to just take a break and let the characters breathe and get to know them in a more intimate way.
I think in the language of modern cinema, you might think of something like Deadpool breaking the fourth wall as a version of soliloquy, perhaps.
I mean, that's an extreme version of it, sure. That's one thing that you could do. But you also have, you know, like I said, the villain's monologue is another mm-hmm. example of that, or Disney's villain's song, right?
Oh, yes.
The villain's song is functionally a soliloquy, right? They're not really singing to, you know, other people may be participating, but the function of it is to help you understand what the villain is doing, why they're doing it, what really makes them tick. And again, in some of the prime examples of the genre, such as Gaston, you also get plot in the same stroke as they elaborate what they're going to do next. Only now you know why.
You know, this kind of made me think specifically the mention of movies and Deadpool doing that directly. Soliloquies have kind of been carried over into cinema. They're not, you know, quite in the same form that they were in the original plays, but we'll sometimes just hear the thoughts of a character in a film as voiceover to what's ongoing. I remember this being not uncommon when I was younger in films. It's been a while since I've gone and watched a lot of movies.
The original Dune had to do this a lot because Dune, of course, you know, 50% of it takes place inside the heads of the respective characters. So Dune had to have these little snippets of voiceover to help you understand, like, at all what's going on at any given time.
I've seen that one, actually. I've not seen the new Dune movies yet.
Yeah, that one does a lot more externalizing, but it also kind of cheats by getting away with a lot by not either underplaying or just avoiding a lot of the more mystical internal lives of the characters. So it kind of cheats a little. But doing that reduces the need for these soliloquies in the form of voiceover. And again, in a lot of this, you can also accomplish by turning it into dialogue. But that only works when the characters in question are, you know, in a position where they can be forthright, where they can talk to someone who for whatever reason is allowed to know whatever the villain has going on. I'm using villains because they're particularly prone to it, but you can have heroes do it too. But the point is where the speaker, I'll generalize it, the speaker can speak freely to another character. But if you have, whenever you have a position where a character is in a position where they cannot speak freely, then soliloquy becomes an important device.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely plenty of cases where you have a character and it just doesn't make sense for them to elaborate on what's going on. That's partly why, like, Bond villains explaining their master plan became the kind of schlocky thing that it is kind of more known as. You explain your plan to the hero escapes from your overcomplicated death trap, and then defeats you.
Right, so that is... So, I have sort of conflicted feelings on this, because, the villain's monologue is useful if done well. It can easily fall into that pitfall, but functionally, on the one hand... If you are a villain and you've been wanting to take your revenge upon the hero for umpteen years, how many times have you practiced that speech? How long have you waited to rub into him, to let him know that you got him, right? So on the one hand, it's perfectly explicable in that fashion. And on the other hand, it can also, again, it fulfills a purpose of helping us understand what is going, not only what's going on with the character internally, but also what is going to happen in the next act. You just have to be careful to not be sloppy with it, right? Like any other tool, it is not a get out of jail free card. You have to actually wield the thing. You know, it's funny, the piece of media that was very famous for pointing out this tendency also indulged in it, right? The Incredibles, right, has that sequence where
you sly dog, you got me,
you
monologuing.
Caught me monologuing, right? But he's poking fun at the trope of monologuing after the movie just indulged in that trope, right? So
yeah,
right, so it's not saying this is an inherently bad thing, because it's not. It's incredibly useful. You just need to use it carefully.
Yeah, Kingsman does quite similar. That's actually why I specifically referred to Bond, because I was thinking of a scene in the movie where they directly reference how you can kind of fall into that trap.
Or you can do the Watchmen thing and say, and have at the end, oh, so now you're going to put your plan into motion? And he says, do you think I would have explained it to you if there was the slightest chance you could stop it? I pushed the button half an hour ago.
I'm not particularly familiar with Watchmen. It's on a very
long
in
the comics,
list
though.
Of comics to read. Yeah, I've heard enough about the film that I figure I should probably read the comics first.
There's one major change in the plot between the comics and the film. I say major. It's basically in terms of, I don't know. I don't know if you want any spoilers on this. Somebody gets framed for something, and who gets framed changes between the comic and the movie.
But one of the reasons that soliloquy and villains' monologues, these tropes, are so important is because they're essential to maintaining irony. So I'm going to throw a definition at you that was given by a much later person and see if it sounds recognizable to the works of Shakespeare that you that you've been referencing to this point. So this was a Hitchcock description, and he was describing what he was defining suspense. And he said, when you have a situation where there's a bomb in the room and the audience knows it, but the characters do not, that is suspense. It's not suspense if the character knows that there's a bomb. It's only suspense if they do not. And the expectation that this has to resolve somehow and the uncertainty of the manner in which it will resolve, that is suspense. But that sounds like a particularly weaponized form of irony, doesn't it?
That is pretty much the definition of dramatic irony, yes.
Which Shakespeare uses a ton.
Dramatic irony pretty much entirely powers the plot of Midsummer Night's Dream.
Yeah, I mean, there's a reason that when we study Shakespeare in schools, we talk about dramatic irony a lot, because there's a lot of it there, and it's easy to dig into. I mean, soliloquies are a great way for ratcheting up dramatic irony, because there's something that, you know, this character is saying that now we, the audience, know, but nobody else does.
Exactly. So that whole definition of suspense that Hitchcock came up with to describe what he was doing, he is using a different medium to get at the same device that Shakespeare was making hay off of 400 years earlier. And man, it is, I can tell you as an author, that when you have something like that and then you're able to resolve it, boy, that's fun.
I don't think I've actually gotten to use it too much, but there's a project I've been working on that has a lot more dramatic irony kind of baked into the concept. But that is a discussion for another time, and speaking of both discussions and time, we're at about an hour here on the recording time, and I still haven't eaten lunch.
That just sounds like bad planning.
That's because it is. Mm-hmm. Ian, do we have anything in the mailbag today?
No, we do not have any new mail in the mailbag this week. So if you want to write to us about your opinions on Shakespeare, let us know what your favorite play is, or if you just totally have been traumatized by schooling and don't like Shakespeare, our email address is fanfictapes@gmail.com. You can also leave us a comment on YouTube. We'd also appreciate it if you'd leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you listen to this show. You can also contact us on social media. We are still on Twitter, formerly known as X, and Maya is in charge of that station.
I use that sometimes. We post occasionally about episodes coming up. I'm trying to get more regular about that as the semester winds down for me. Handles at fanfictiontapes, capital F, capital T. There are no spaces or anything such as that. It's there. It's the only current social media account. Our next episode is about storytelling in music. Because there is more of that than what is casually obvious.
The aforementioned villain songs, I would argue.
Those are certainly
one of
them.
That might be a good thing to bring up, yeah.
Brian, before we go, do you have anything you'd like to promote to our listeners?
Sure. So my current project, there's actually a good bit of dramatic irony built into this because, so the current project is a role reversal story set in the Ruby fandom called War Machines. Now, what happened was another author started writing the story, then disappeared and took the story with them. And after a while, I thought, you know, I really enjoyed this story. I want there to be a similar premise story out there in the world. So I started writing it. And eventually, when I got to the point where I was ready to post, I started posting. And someone said, hey, I think you might be able to contact the original author here. So I did. And they said, oh, well, that's funny. I've been reworking the story in the background offline. I just hadn't gotten around to posting it. But now that you're posting, I suppose I'll start posting too. And so now there are two versions of War Machines. And I apologize, but
you know, that's actually that's kind of funny because independently, I ran across someone posting on Tumblr a couple days ago about this.
That's funny. But yeah, that's the current project. It's War Machines. It's a role reversal AU set in the Ruby fandom. And boy, I'm having so much fun with it.
All righty. Well, I suppose it is time for us to exit Pursued by a Bear.
Shakespearean stage direction.
All right, folks. I am and have been Maya. And today I was joined by...
Ryan.
And I am Ian. Until next time, bye.